Okay. New paper. Paper 114. Which is old single column, page 1250. All right. Well, I'm not going to really preface it because the preface is there, as you'll see. Let me start reading, and then we'll talk about it. Let's just jump right in. Who would like to read for us? We got a reader.
I'll read.
Okay.
Paper 114, Seraphic Planetary Government. The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men through many celestial forces and agencies, but chiefly through the ministry of seraphim.
Okay, so now, notice what they did there.
One short sentence,
paragraph all by itself. So short, that if you've got, a book with the big initial letters, it doesn't even make it around the big initial letter. It's such a short paragraph. Okay. Why would they do that? Okay, it's exactly what I was trying to point out the last couple of weeks. They're trying to make it as clear as possible without coming right out and saying it, because they want you to really discover it so that you go, so that it's your understanding. But they do everything they can to put arrows in. They are going to now contrast from, by and large, seraphim functioning as in a mother-like mode. I mean, yes, guardian angels weren't born here. In terms of just being a guardian angel or a guardian of destiny, you're intervening in the affairs of humans. But once you're here, remember a lot of them stay for a long, long time, doing group after group after group of mortals. They're very place-like, and they're working, encompassing you, surrounding you in their ministry, trying to support you but challenge you. It's a mother-like mode in terms of what they're actually doing once they've been injected, onto the planet. But there's a whole bunch of seraphim that, they come here just like the guardian angels, but they're here to be an insertion. They're not here to be, really trying to uphold and sustain you and your efforts to be an ascending son of God. They're here to over-control, to direct. The whole reason they're here is to is for the sake of the planet, not for the sake of individuals. And by planet, we don't mean, dirt is sacred. We all need dirt to stand on, but, there is an ongoing civilization that has to be fostered, and an eventual age of light and life of that civilization, that begins to plug that planet into the cosmos as a, as an eternal phenomenon. That whole aspect is very fatherlike. And there's nothing more definitive in the revelation relative to past understandings of God that that better delineates the God of law from the God of love than the Most High's. Just search the book for every time it says the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. And you've got all of the highlights that should make it very, very clear that this this is not softball a lot of times. Many times, in order to ensure that civilization goes on and there will be an age of light and life, it has to be very difficult for some individuals. You know, and those who help individuals in difficult times will help those individuals in difficult times, but there are those that make the times difficult. And the Most Highs are the definitive hand behind that. You want to really, you know, feel the that Almighty God hand behind the Most Highs. You know, they don't facilitate in the kingdoms of men; they rule in the kingdoms of men, and they mean that very literally. So that's, you know, that's the whole point. It's just, you know, and rather than making it in bold face, they make it a little tiny paragraph unto itself, you know, the equivalent thing to really emphasize that's the very first thing, the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. Now, think about what we're about to say. Yeah, that's the whole point.
At noon today, the roll call of planetary angels, guardians, and others on Urantia was 501,234,619 pairs of seraphim. There were assigned to my command 200 seraphic hosts, 597,196,800 pairs of seraphim, or 1,194,393,600 individual angels. The registry, however, shows 1,469,238
individuals. You can do it.
It follows, therefore, that 191,924,362 angels were absent from this world on transport, messenger, and death duty. On Urantia, there are about the same number of cherubim as seraphim, and they are similarly organized.
Okay.
Real matter of fact flavor right off the bat.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, why? Again, you know, ask yourself why. I mean, obviously, you're not going to be distinguished about whether or not you make it to the Isle of Paradise or not, whether or not you've memorized those numbers. Okay. It's sad to record that, but why? Why are they doing this? I mean, in part, it's something we've seen many times. You know, they want, you know, in case you are, you know, losing track of it, you know, for a moment, they want to remind you, you know, that, you know, every hair on every head is known, you know, and, you know, the entire universe is very, very intimately and precisely known. You know, don't ever let anyone tell you otherwise. You know, every grain of sand is known. You know, to the side of that, I mean, you know, more specifically, it must immediately follow from that opening sentence. So, you know, what's the point? You know, if the point is about intervention, you might say, well, okay, they're going to tell me there is some intervention in human affairs. I guess every once in a blue moon, you know, there's some stray celestial being, you know, that happens to be on this world and does something. No, just the angels, okay? There's this huge number, just seraphim, okay? And... you know, so intervention is a big thing. When they say ruling in the kingdoms of men, if that has to be really burrowing down into details, no problem. There's plenty of beings to engage as much detail as needed. If they don't have it, they'll call in more. Okay? That's part of the point. It's just it's, you know, it's meant to get you, you know, to realize that there is a measure of truth to the so-called sacred history, you know, back in the Old Testament, you know, where it seems like God is micromanaging, you know, every little jot and tittle, you know, of his chosen people. Yes and no. there has been a lot of very detailed intervention because it's designed that way. And notice, too, it's just, you know, a little aside, you know, and rattling off all those huge numbers, They're telling you something that's kind of interesting to, you know, keep in the back of your mind. Why don't they assign the angels in units of armies? See, they're assigning them in units of hosts. You know, there's 200 hosts. You know, it's 12 hosts make an army. 12 doesn't go into 200 evenly. So that's just an interesting little point, you know, to think about. And you can probably answer that if you just go back and, you know, at least to a degree you can answer, if you go back and look at who's in charge of the groups, you know, and who's in charge of armies, you know, and is he here? You know, is he intimate with armies? And the answer is no, it's Gabriel. You know, so you have sort of those army units are sort of overseen from on high, you know, but yeah, the actual units are there with their commander, you know, are the hosts are the biggest ones that are.
So what does that mean? I don't understand what you just said about 200 seraphic hosts. What's the difference between hosts and?
Okay, but I remember we went through all that here a couple weeks ago. You know, you have groups of 12, you know, and then 12 of those groups of 12 make a company.
Oh, yeah.
144 pairs, you know, and all the way on up until you get to a host is just exactly what they're, you know, if you divide that by 200, you'll get the size of a host. You know, and 12 of those hosts make an army, the biggest unit. You know, just there, you know, that's the basics of what they're trying to give you there. The precision to which everything is known, you know, he didn't say, you know, notice, you know, at noon today, you know, it's a constantly dynamic phenomenon. He, you know, he just, you know, this is the chief of Seraphim, remember, that's writing this. And so, you know, he's got that register always in front of him, and he just looks, you know, right at noon, as, you know, as I'm, you know, this is the number. You know, 2 seconds later, you know, I mean, you know.
Right. Because he also says that there's 191 missing.
91 million.
Missing.
Right.
Or not missing,
but off
not there,
world.
Just off world.
Right. Yeah. See, they're off world because, of course, they're doing transport. Or they're taking care of souls, they're on death duty. Or some of them are on temporary assignment, you know, as messenger hosts, you know, like, say, technical advisors, you know, part of the messengers. That, you know, so some of them are, you know, really, really doing the jobs that are, you know, quite removed from the ministering spirit jobs, you know, ministering to a planet or to individuals. You know, they're off on messenger duty.
But why so precise at this moment?
They just, again, they want you to recognize that the number of hairs on your head are known at every moment.
Okay.
You know, and that intelligence of knowingness, you don't have to go all the way up to the infinite spirit or something to have that kind of vast, detailed knowingness. You know, way down in the trenches, they know very, very precisely what's going on at every moment. You know, so you're not going to be caught off guard very easily.
And it's kind of a matter of course. It's kind of a matter of course for them. This is what one of their functions. So it's not like they have to go and ask a million people, "Well, what's our total here?"
Right.
You know, they can.
They just know.
They
it.
Pick it off the top of their heads, like Chris is picking off what he's talking about.
Good analogy.
Maybe better than me, but you know.
One of the things that occurs to me is, even those who are big numbers, you know, a couple of billion, the population of China is currently, and I don't know what it was in 34, but currently it's about 600 billion.
6.7 billion.
So 6, yeah, not 600. But so that partly that gives you a little bit of information about how many personal guardian angels there are, group guardian angels, whatever.
Not huge numbers, see. Obvious, not huge numbers, obviously.
Yeah, they don't get into the specifics of that. But if there really was a one-to-one, we would have like 12 billion angels on the planet versus...
Well, you'd have a lot more than that because, you know, huge numbers of these are not working as guardians.
That was my other point here.
You know, that's what we're about to get into. You know?
Numbers of planetary angels and guardian angels.
Right.
So this is the total.
Right.
And I don't know if it gives us.
It doesn't give us any real sense.
Percentage, how many are guardian, how many are planetary.
But you did just, you know, yeah, I was just going to make that point. Okay. Yeah, that was, yeah. You know, to notice that they, you know, they give you those two categories, planetary angels and guardian, well, and others. You know. Yeah. But the two that they point out are these two papers.
Yeah.
First paper is a guardian, the second one a planetary. Okay. And you know, and you'll see that, you know, again, this Most High ruling in the kingdoms of men and, you know, all those involved, it's not a minor issue. So there's vast numbers of those angels that are involved in those issues. So, yeah, it's a good reminder that you don't have a lot of one-on-one angelic, you know, guardianship.
But then we don't know how many.
Yeah, been over here.
We don't know how many of the undisclosed seraphim there are either.
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, they did mention the cherubim, you know, are about the same numbers, but
right. Yeah. There's that order we don't
who
know
knows about. How many of the lesser, you know, ones.
That's
there are.
That's why they call it we don't know about.
Yeah. I think giving things like all these numbers is not just a matter of showing precision. There's a revelation here about order and pattern and structure that's important.
Yep.
It's not just the numbers. It's the fact that there's this order.
Yeah, exactly. And I've made that point a few other times when we've run into those similar things. But yeah, that's another one of the things that's in play, definitely. You know, that, and that point is pretty quickly made the moment that you discover this book, you know, and start flipping through it, and it's like, holy mackerel, you know, I mean, it's this vast hierarchy, you know, of, I thought it was just, you know, Earth and some magic bearded guy, you know, I thought that's all there was, you know. And no, it's extremely complex.
Somebody like Walt Disney.
Yeah. But not only is it huge and complex and hierarchical, but it's also very, very precisely run. Was there more? Yeah.
When I said, why so technical? I mean, why so precise? Why would they give us, you know, the individual and the pairs when we could do that math ourselves? Now, that didn't make any sense to me.
There's reasons pedagogically.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead, Bobby.
Well, the main reason would be because our notion of angels is that they function singly, and they're trying to reinforce for us the idea that they function in pairs, and so the actual numbers of individuals that are here, they want us to know that. In many cases, they're functioning as teams. They're pairing them up, so they want us to know that. The other thing is,
adding to that is, you know, and if you actually do the math, you go, yep, the number is exactly twice, right? So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's not kind of sort of they're in pairs,
yeah,
you know? they're precisely in pairs.
Yeah. Yeah. Incidentally. In 1935, the estimate is about 2.2 billion people on Earth at that time. We're closer actually to 6.9 billion right now. 6.9 billion about mid-February.
But it's sad to record that we don't have that many more angels now.
Yes. Where is this recorded?
We know that.
That's reasonable. I'm just being.
That was the point I wanted to make. You brought up that the Most High is looking at the long arc, and that population growth is certainly part of the long arc. So if they need more angels to come in, they don't get here instantaneously. You know, or if they need more on death duty during World War II.
But they don't need to get here instantaneously because they project most of these things in advance.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Okay, we need more for the population. Yeah. I mean, there's trillions and trillions in the universe, and they can manufacture more if they need them.
Yes. Now we're up to 1,100 guardians.
Right, I mean, just, recognize that, you know, they've charted, you know, the numbers they're going to need, you know, who knows how many, you know, centuries or even millennia in advance I'm sure they have vast, long-range projections of all these things.
Plus, I understand they're pretty good with math.
Yeah, yeah. And remember, and they always point out when they're talking about the angels, you know, there's this group, and the reserves. Yeah, they've always got a vast number of reserves that are all sitting there ready to go.
How long does it take for somebody to come from Eversa here?
Well, from Eversa is a very, very long time. You know, it's, you know, 200,000 light years, so... you know, even at the three times the speed of light, that's a long time.
You can get a little glimpse of the situation here on the planet. When you, you look at these numbers from 1930, whatever, and 2.2 billion people.
Yeah, that's rough. Yeah.
Okay, so that means that at any moment in time, there are roughly 2.2 billion free will choices being made that alter the way reality is progressing. Right now, there are 6.7 or 6.9 billion free will choices being made constantly. That is a challenge.
But for fortunately, like we're trying to point out, for the complexity of it right now, it's sad to record. You know, that most of those people are not doing a lot of free will personality choice. Most of them are functioning pretty predictably, so much so that, you know, this pair of angels can handle 1,000 and, you know. Just always, you know, challenge yourself to remember that part of the revelation. They're trying to get us to be very humble about that. Don't think that you're big stuff yet, you know, because by and large we aren't. We're fairly easy to manage in terms of that big picture. And the place where we're difficult to manage is down there in the details, which are, you know, irrelevant from. Yeah, I mean, remember, most of the time we're praying about all those minutiae little details, and what did it just tell you in the previous paper? Guardian angels ignore those prayers. You know, they ignore prayers. You know, they've got jobs and they're doing them.
God doesn't ignore the prayers, but
it's not like the angel is, you know, is following you around listening. Oh, now he wants me to do this. You know, I mean, they don't care.
It's almost just the opposite.
Right,
really.
Right. It's probably, they're the reason you're praying.
They've got an agenda for us. You and about 2 billion other people.
Yeah, take a number and stand in line.
So I was thinking a light and life planet then would have maybe a trillion.
Busy stuff.
A trillion angels. I mean, because then everybody would need a pair, right?
Of course, population doesn't continue to exponentiate, you know.
Right, they might have a lower population.
Yeah.
But still, that's going to
be. Certainly, you know, you can imagine how teeming architectural, you know, spheres are with beings. And you've got a mortal sphere in light and life. It's teeming, you know, with beings of every description. So, yeah. All right, let's some more here.
Seraphim and their associated cherubim have much to do with the details of the superhuman government of a planet, especially of worlds which have been isolated by rebellion. The angels, ably assisted by the midwayers, function on Urantia as the actual supermaterial ministers who execute the mandates of the resident governor general and all his associates and subordinates. Seraphim, as a class, are occupied with many assignments other than those of personal and group guardianship. Urantia is not without proper and effective supervision from the system, constellation, and universe rulers. But the planetary government is unlike that of any other world in the Satania system, even in all Nebadon. This uniqueness in your plan of supervision is due to a number of unusual circumstances. 1, the life modification status of Urantia. 2, the exigencies of the Lucifer Rebellion.
You know, the things that were necessitated by the Lucifer Rebellion, you know, to backfill the hole that was left there.
3, the disruptions of the Adamic default. 4, the irregularities growing out of the fact that Urantia was one of the bestowal worlds of the universe sovereign. Michael of Nebadon is the planetary prince of Urantia. 5, the special function of the 24 planetary directors. Sixth, the location on the planet of an archangel's circuit. And seven, the more recent designation of the one-time incarnated Macaventa Melchizedek as vicegerent planetary prince.
Okay. Yeah. Just one little thing. Notice up there the end of that third paragraph, how they said that seraphim as a class are occupied with many assignments, yeah, other than, you know, what everyone thinks about them. You know, they're just, you know, guardian angels. Like, no, they have so vast numbers of those, you know, billion plus are involved in things beyond being ministering spirits. And you notice how they've put things in order here. You know, you go all the way back to, you know, starting it up as a decimal planet, there, you know, and then you've got 200,000 years ago, you got the Lucifer Rebellion, and then you've got the default, and then of course you remember that just prior to the public ministry, Jesus was, you know, technically became planetary prince of Urantia, you know, after the little back and forth on Mount Hermon with Satan and Caligastia. Now he wasn't publicly declared as such until the time of the next. Around the time of the next two there. You have the dispensational resurrection. You know, that's happening there. You know, right after Jesus dies, and then at Pentecost you have the planetary adjudication. When this planetary government that we're going to be talking about was set up, so the 420 counselors, that was, you know, they're part of this. They were set up at Pentecost. The archangel circuit and the divisional headquarters. I mean, the first time they used the archangel circuit was to announce the dispensational resurrection at the time of Jesus, and then finally. You know, sometime around the beginning of the 20th century is when Macaventa was given this new title of vicegerent planetary prince, and then it was at that time, since we then, you know, at least technically had a son, you know, assigned to this planet directly. That's when Satan was interned. You know, so right around the beginning of the 20th century, sometimes when they rounded Satan up and he wasn't wandering around the rebellion spheres anymore, like he was right up to that time. You know, so that takes you just, you know, right up to the beginning of the 20th century here, of these things that make us oddball.
That number six there. Is an angelic circuit? Archangel circuit.
Yeah.
How many planets does that? I mean, I thought there was one on every planet.
No. Go back and read. Was it paper 37 or whatever with the archangels? Yeah. Do you realize? Yeah. You guys remember that line? What it means to have an archangel divisional headquarters on your planet? And of course, the answer is no. or Jim wouldn't have asked that question.
How many planets?
This is like
two,
radically.
It's only two in Nebula. Yeah.
Oh, two in Nebula.
Divisional headquarters. I don't think that's the case.
No.
They're not telling us. But,
no, they don't
but
tell.
It's probably safe to surmise that no other world, no other planet.
Yeah.
There may be another one, but what would be the circumstance? It's the fact that this is Michael's bestowal sphere, unique among 10 million worlds,
yeah.
That's unusual in and of itself. You would indicate that a divisional headquarters would at least be on some world of a system, maybe, or a constellation. Something like that.
What do you mean, like Gerizim or an architectural?
Some architectural sphere of some sort, you know.
It's not usual to put it on a planet.
Yeah, you know, and remember, you know, the archangels are, you know, have a lot to do with the ascension scheme. so, you know, it's very upside down, see, from their perspective. That, you know, that's the first thing that strikes them. It's like, what on earth? You're ministering the ascension scheme from the bottom of the trench? What's up with that?
Seven times.
Remind you of how Michael just turned the whole thing upside down in so many ways. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. He really upset the normal or hierarchical structure of things.
It also means that they must have a pretty good subspace communication system.
Yeah, and you know, they mentioned later on, it's very handy to have that, you know. So unlike the other 36, right, rebellion spheres, we've got some communication. You know, the planetary government here has some, you know, immediate communication abilities. You know, those poor other, you know, planetary governments. Yeah, and just, you know, just before that, just, you know, so I don't forget to say it, tied with, you know, talking about Machaventa being made vicegerent and Satan being rounded up. I mean, you know, that implies, the fact they tell you that those two happened at the same time, that means the other 36 got something too. Some sort of, you know, vicegerent, you know, or you know, something, temporary something, you know, be, you know, that, because that's what, you know, it's that's causes Satan to be allowed to be, you know, rounded up. So, you know, there's an indirect thing there too about the other worlds.
Yeah. I'm sure a lot of people figure this out, but they're revealing to us how to get our planet at least back on track or get a kickstart on the cosmic age, right?
Well, what they're really revealing is the planet will be put on track. And humans need to start recognizing that the Most Highs, and one day the civil leaders of this world will realize that the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men. One day we'll realize that humanism is a great fallacy, you know, and that mankind is not the salvation of the earth. It doesn't need to be saved. They've got it covered. Even the bottom tiers, there's over a billion seraphim, okay? You know, a bunch of meathead humans thinking that, you know, if they don't do something, the earth is lost is a really, really, you know, incredibly blind thought. Okay. The Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men. If it's important, they're on it. If it's not important, they don't need to be on it. You're not needed. Okay. Well, now, if you'd like to help, it would make it a lot easier for them. If you weren't, you know, thwarting everything they were trying to do, they could certainly use your help in that sense. But they don't have to have your help. You know, if they have to do it with everyone trying to go at right angles to the truth, then they'll do it that way. But, you know, everyone needs to recognize that the more we go at right angles to what they're doing, the more... what's good for the most people for the longest period of time is going to be bad for a short period of time for those people that are, you know, cross purposes to the Most Highs. You know, and you know, and not to belittle it, but you know, Jar Jar Binks said it very well. You know, you say people are going to die. Okay, that's what we're talking about. You don't want to find yourself going across purposes. When the Most Highs decide this is important and they need to step in, you know, because you're not going to be what's best for the most people for the longest period of time. Okay, we have to. That doesn't mean that the ministering spirits are not going to be right there ministering to you as you're dying, but you're not going to make it much longer because you're thwarting an essential element of progressing civilization, and they're not going to allow that. Okay.
That's why they rounded up
Satan. Yeah, I mean, right. But, you know, of course, they didn't round up Caligastia and Dalagastia.
Can't find them.
But, and they also didn't round up all the clueless people on the planet.
In the cave somewhere.
Tora Bora.
No. So just, you know, that's... That's why they separate these, you know, just, you know, this discussion. You want to start looking at angels with two eyes, not just with your spirit eye, because it's a distorted understanding of seraphim. If you only look at them as ministering spirits to individuals, as guardians, they're also ministering spirits to planets as over-controllers, directors. And that's the material eye. I go back right before the inevitabilities. You know, the Father is trying to rule in your heart, you know, going from thought changer to thought adjuster to thought controller. But it doesn't always get what he's attempting there, because you can say no even to his absolute love. Okay? So the rule of love in the hearts of men doesn't always succeed. But the rule of law in the kingdoms of men always does. Okay? That is not going to be thwarted by free will exercising. It will get overruled, you know, in the big picture. And you say, well, how can you can't, they don't have any right to overrule my free will. Well, it should be a reminding. You don't have any free will control over the big picture. That wasn't ever given to you. They're not thwarting your free will. That's delusional to think that you've been given free will control of the planet. We're not self-governing, you know, in the big sense. See, that's what that's trying to teach you, is to get you to bring in some humility. You've been given a very, very circumscribed region of absolute free will control. You can choose eternity or reject it, absolutely. Anything outside of that little circle is relative, and rapidly, you know, more and more relative as you move any distance away. You know, I'm definitely, by the time you get to something that embraces the totality of the planet, now, you know, you have no say as an individual.
Yes, those free will choices are relative. But someone like the 9/11 hijackers, I mean, somebody makes a relative choice, but look, it impacts.
They make a decision, it's an individual making a decision, but just again, you know, separate. I mean, they may have made a choice to be, you know, way back at some point, to be pretty devoid of connection to the cosmos. But then they're just playing out decisions. There's all kinds of decisions that seem inescapable to them once they've made certain choices. Decisions that, you know, the only way to deal with the infidels is to kill them. That's not really a choice, that's a decision about how to handle the details in front of them. The choice is internal. I choose to circumscribe my notion of God and of the cosmos thus. You know, and once you do that, then there's a whole bunch of decisions, mindful decisions, that follow from that spiritual choice. Like I've tried to point out, I mean, it's a pretty dicey spiritual choice to choose to believe that you have no internal moral compass, no still small voice that you might want to quiet your mind and listen for, that there is no such thing. You choose to believe that there is no such thing. Well, the decisions that follow from that are likely to be difficult for those around you. If you're not challenging yourself to try to have an internal moral compass, if you're just saying, okay, I just need to look to that external authority figure, he'll tell me what's right and wrong. It's a serious lemming problem. Once you've made that choice, all those other things really aren't choices. And the relatives are trying to get us to appreciate that. Those are decisions, not choices. They're decisions that are just inevitable because of the choice that you made up front. Spiritual choices, mental decisions.
You bring up an interesting point, though, when you're talking about, you know, flipping it around from the individual choice, mm-hmm. and then looking at the love perspective versus the law perspective, the individual perspective versus the mass of humanity perspective.
Collective.
When you look at that and you apply a specific, you know, for instance, you know, the oft-used Nazi Germany or Stalin, you know, in power or any of those things.
Pol Pot or whatever.
Pol Pot, any of those guys, okay? So you look at that and you realize, okay, with regard to the total, their will has been circumscribed. They're not allowed to mess with the law equation, okay? Law does prevail.
And they can't touch a soul.
Right. However, they do have the ability to dispatch, you know, hundreds and thousands and even millions of human beings, you know, and curtail their choice to be on the planet. Now, that begs the question, that really puts in contrast, it's one of those real life situations that makes you wonder, okay, well, as I get closer to that middle point, you know, where these things begin to blend, you know, how do these two different things, the law and the love of God, affect each other?
Mm-hmm.
And it's the black and white thinking that we tend to get into that tends to cause us to polarize and go one way or the other, like the big question on the love of God side, how could God allow this to happen?
Right.
And for the existentialists, oh shit, it's all going down the toilet. You know? Somehow, in the middle of all of that, we're being given the opportunity to really get a sense of what reality is like when we explore both these aspects and try to get to the middle and say, okay, what really was the limit of Hitler's choice and decision on, you know, with regard to both individuals, himself, and on the other hand, with regard to how far he was allowed to affect the mass of humanity. And the reason I bring up Hitler is because there's all kinds of Urantia Book Apocrypha about the fact that the Contact Commission was told, you know, that, you know, you've got something coming and you have an opportunity to make changes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's apocryphal, and you can go ahead and throw it out and do whatever. But the fact is that as a world, as we approach Hitler and we look at things like the appeasement, you know, mm-hmm. issue with Czechoslovakia and that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
we had choices that we could make. And we're in that same kind of position today. We were in that position in this country in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and we had decision points that would have been decided differently if higher choices had been made in advance. Mm-hmm. But in advance, you know, many people chose self. You know, and so when you get to a difficult decision point, you know, you make sure that the decision reflects the immediate path of least resistance for you, not the best for the most people for the longest period of time. You know, appeasement in the face of an obvious global aggressor, you know, maybe it'll be fine for 5 years for you, and you're getting old, and maybe you'll die before it gets bad. But what about the others? And those are the kind of choices that the planet is moving into in many ways. It's not just an obvious militaristic, warlike sort of issues. But there's global catastrophes in many areas that are looming. You know, and if we go into those decision points that are coming upon us with secularism and humanism as the initial choices, what kind of decisions are going to be made relative to those choices? Okay? You know, one of the reasons I keep stressing, you know, this part of it that they're trying to bring on this paper is, like I said, we've got to recognize that if we continue to just play the decisions that result from those self-centered choices, there will be intervention on a large scale. Because they're not going to let a world that has an archangel's divisional headquarters on it cease to exist. They're not going to let the world that is where Michael is going to return to unravel. You know, that's part of why. Do you realize what it means to have a divisional headquarters here? That means that all of your silly notions, you know, that if you blink wrong, the world is going to end, are just that. I mean, do you really think that you're going to thwart the planning and whatnot that's involved in putting a divisional headquarters on a planet? Do you think that your use of chemistry or physics and ignorance is going to thwart that? No, it's not going to happen. And to not think with one eye or the other when you have that thought, you know... And think from one eye to the other really fast that you're trying to somehow find some intermediate point. You're not trying to find the intermediate point. You're trying to have both eyes wide open, and you're trying to see it in 3D for the first time. It's both simultaneously. So you do what you can do to make the world a better place, but you're not needed to ensure the age of light and life. You know, those two are not incompatible. You know, just because the Most Highs will do what they need to do doesn't mean, well, I'm going to get what I can right now, and they'll just, you know, mop up my mess.
Yeah.
You know, that is not just evil. That's not just error. That's sin. Okay? And you just twisted your soul when you acted upon that. You know, and it may be your undoing. If not in this life, in the next, you know. So that, you know, they're trying to get it, you know. So that's where you play those thoughts to, you know. The issue of you is, you know, do you want to help or do you want to destroy yourself? You know, because if you're consciously not helping, then you're destroying yourself. You can't destroy the world. They'll do what they need to do to make sure the world's okay. But you will destroy yourself.
The thought that comes up to me is that the Most High and all the decision makers, they don't have a date in mind that we have to hit Light and Life 1 at year 5000.
Yeah.
If we go through several cycles of the Dark Ages because of our own planetary choices,
yeah.
You know, some of those are Hitlerian, as an individual, but some of them are, you know,
the systemic ones are the difficult ones.
Yeah, and you know, it means that you know, this 6.9 billion people are collectively, their consciousness is making these choices, and that's what they've got to deal with. You know, the arc is thousands and thousands of years long. It will happen, and you know, if the Magna Carta has to happen as one of those primary choices, it will happen. But all the Hundred Years' Wars around it also happen. But the events that bring you there, in other words, they're not going to intervene so that it shortens the time.
Right, and just, you know, the point that leads into this next section. You know, the reason that they can't plan in fine detail way out is because no one knows some of the huge wild cards in play, how they're going to be played. Remember, this is a wild card world, as they just listed, you know, the seven wild cards here. Okay, and no one knows how some of these latter cards, you know, even the first one, remember, you know, not even the life carriers know exactly how the... how that first card is going to play out and stuff. So, you know, they plan in very dynamic ways. And they have to be ready at every moment for, you know, what if tomorrow, you know, Mach Eventa comes? You know, or even some say, what if tomorrow Michael comes? You know, and they're going, oh, he's not going to do that. Oh, well, I think maybe, you know. So, you know, they argue about this stuff because they're trying, because they've got to argue all the different scenarios because they've got to be ready for any one of them. All right, okay.
Christian,
talking about choices and decisions, it seems to me that that's the human side of this.
Mm-hmm.
And the spiritual side of it is our values. You know, the book says that we don't possess values. They exist outside of us. All we can do is choose them.
Right.
And so it seems to me that the real frontier here is the illumination of values. And if they apply more intervention and more pressure, it's to illuminate the values that we have to choose from when we're making choices.
And of course, true values, you know, because you're exactly right. You just are naturally tying that choice thing to values, but you know, or at least what you think are values. You know, recognizing that you may be deceiving yourself. You know, and you know with the best of intentions, you've chosen a false value and not a true value. You were trying to choose value. You knew you weren't trying to, you know, choosing fact or even truth. You were trying to choose goodness and value. You were trying to go all the way to that end and grab a hold of it and draw yourself towards it. But in your ignorance, you chose the very opposite. Because every one of these, you know, has an opposite. For every, you know, if there's truth, then there's the potential of untruth, you know, in a non-all-seeing mind. So, you know, and again, the only way that we can get out of the position that we're in, where we're constantly choosing false value, even when we were trying to choose true value, is with revelation. We need the bigger picture, so that we can. So that there's less error and evil. You know, that's a big problem. I mean, sin is another issue. But just, you know, the fact that you're, even when you're trying, you're getting the wrong one, it starts to become a real problem when you're trying to move into advancing civilization. Because advancing civilization is predicated more on those values than it is on facts. And sort of just the inertia of facts, and, you know, the cattle prods of facts, you know, war, slavery, social classes, and, you know, and profit motive. All right, so this whole question of how some of these wild cards are going to play out, that's tied to this sovereignty question.
Number one, the sovereignty of Urantia. The original sovereignty of Urantia was held in trust by the sovereign of the Satania system. It was first delegated by him to a joint commission of Melchizedeks and life carriers. And this group functioned on Urantia until the arrival of a regularly constituted planetary prince.
Remember the situation there where, you know, part of the plan was to bring about will creatures, you know, in essentially a more primitive state than normal, and they had planned for all that, you know, to bring in those 12 Melchizedek observers that they're alluding to there, you know, to join in the life carriers, and you know, oversee the situation until the planetary prince could come with the arrival of the Sangiks. Yeah, so that's what they're referring to there.
So wouldn't it be, they don't name him, but wouldn't the sovereign of the system of the Satania at that time
have been Lucifer?
Yeah, definitely.
Subsequent to the downfall of Prince Caligastia, at the time of the Lucifer Rebellion, Urantia had no sure and settled relationship with the local universe and its administrative divisions until the completion of Michael's bestowal in the flesh.
No one ever holds it.
When he was proclaimed by the Union of Days, Planetary Prince of Urantia.
Okay, now what was this? So subsequent to the downfall, no sure and settled relationship. What was the primary thing that was going on that whole time, you know, accepting those, that brief little stint of yours when Adam, before Adam and Eve defaulted. What was the basic oversight mechanism throughout all that span of time? Do you remember?
From when to when?
From 200,000 years ago up until 2,000 years ago.
Damn.
Melchizedek receivers. 12 Melchizedek receivers. Yeah, not those 12 Melchizedek observers, back at the beginning, but the 12 Melchizedek receivers, which came in right at the rebellion, stayed up to Adam and Eve, left, but had to immediately, you know, the same 12 immediately had to come back. And they don't tell you if, you know, there could have been common Melchizedeks between the two groups. They don't tell you, but it sounds like from the way they word it that it was pretty much a two separate groups of 12. Anyway, so you had, you know, including Machaventa as one of those 12 receivers. And so for all the way up until 2,000 years ago, you know, the Melchizedeks have played a huge role on this planet, much, much more so than in any normal world. So that's another thing that's sort of behind this list of seven. That's why I, you know, was pausing like this and pulling this out. That's another wild card that's in play as a corollary of these. That because of this, the Melchizedeks have had a huge hand. You know, almost Midsoniter world, like you might even, you know, wonder, you know, what does that do to this world, especially long term when we finally get things, you know, put back, you know, together a bit, you know, to have so much Melchizedek influence. How does that differentiate us from other worlds?
Well, it's important. It's important in that context, you know, and you're trying to illuminate it, but just to remember, okay, well, it's normally Lanonidex that are in charge of things here. And it's normally the Brahmanex, the Most Highs, that are ruling in the kingdoms of men.
You know, from on high.
But the Melchizedeks above that are actually here and watching over things and getting an idea. You know, Melchizedeks are no slouches.
Yeah.
You know, they're emergency sons. They're, you know, tuned in.
Very versatile.
Yes.
Also teachers, though. That's their main function. Teachers.
I mean, you know, you immediately say that, and it's just popping your head, oh, yeah, there's the Trinity teacher sons. You suppose that changes that, the fact that there was teacher-like beings from the beginning. Yeah. See, you can start to speculate, and that's why I wanted you to do it. Just, you know, they want you to, you know, to start to get familiar with all of this and not have it be gobbledygook. They want you to really... You know, when someone says Melchizedek, there should be all kinds of things, you know, definitive things that come to mind. It's not just a word. And it's like, wow, what does that mean about my world? I know a lot about Melchizedek. They've revealed a lot about him, you know. And they want you to really start thinking about your world in this cosmic context, you know, rather than just being some mysterious name in Genesis and in the book of Hebrews. You know?
Isn't it becoming more of a... conversation piece about the Melchizedeks between the religions of the world right now?
Well, you know, it's because of the fact that, especially because of the book of Hebrews, it'd be pretty minor if all you had was Genesis, you know.
And the Mormons.
But well, that's why, you know, the Mormons and others, you know, really key in on the book of Hebrews. And, you know, and Melchizedek, you know, it's like, you know, it just seems to be demanding to have some sort of complex theology about Melchizedek, you know, what those statements in the book of Hebrews. And so many have done just that. They've created, you know, all kinds of notions trying to rationalize what they see there in the book of Hebrews.
So when they Google Melchizedek, they get this?
Yeah, well, yeah. Just imagine how much they get this now, because, you know, everyone knows how many hits, you know, within the UB you get now. It's not like there's just one electronic copy on the web now. It's everywhere. And, you know, and so you Google Melchizedek and you've got a billion UB references in your face.
Yeah. Just one other little thought on, in terms of the Melchizedeks as teachers. We need to remember that the Sanguinetic stock is designed to live alongside a race of teachers,
yeah,
which was derailed. So now you've got the genetic stock that's open and ready for teachers, but no teachers.
Yeah, yeah, there's all those things. Yeah, you know, the stuff that was meant to be, that, you know, that wasn't, that kind of got sort of put into the Noddites and hence put into mankind, and all these various things, you know, they all feed together. And it just, it's a wild card world, you know. In space, exactly. I mean, because all these, the point I was just trying to make, all these things have super additive consequences, yeah, too. You know, so all these things combine together. When you combine this with this, you know, and so it's a very, very, very complex equation that these people have to be trying to project in and be ready.
See, that's what I was talking about. Even way back then, before the Lucifer Rebellion, the arc of we're going to get this planet to the age of life and light was visualized as this route. Well, a few things intervened in the meantime, you know, and it got pushed off. It still doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. It's like, oh, well, now we've got this set of circumstances to work with, and this set, and this set, and this set. There, like you say, the versatility is cosmic.
Yeah. And you know, that's why there's so many student visitors who come here, because this is the real test case. You know, what if you change everything, basically, with changeable?
Yes. in an old issue almost 30 years ago now of Urantian Sojourn, John Andrews, a reader from Juneau, Alaska, wrote an article, you know, based on essentially these 7 points, saying the title of the article was Urantia, Model for the Supreme. You know, the idea was, you know, if you changed everything up, how much play does that allow the Supreme, you know, to actually allow a full hand in the affairs of what's going on?
And that's a, you know, brilliant point. That's exactly one of the things that they actually want you to kind of start to put together through these 2 papers before you go into the Supreme papers, to just recognize that, you know, the normal scheme of things is very pre-planned, father-like. Dinka 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 dink, light and life. You know, everything that basically can be changed about that normal order of things has been. That which Revelation fails to accomplish, you know, most of the father-like revelations, he dropped the ball. That which Revelation fails to accomplish, evolution in the hand of the mother always does. That the Supreme will play a huge role on this planet.
As the story would be like that.
And see, and then you can start to think about, okay, so, you know, we know he's a master son. We know he's, you know, he's now intimately engaged with this Supreme. This is his world. This is a world that needs the Supreme. How much might he be part of the real means by which supremacy comes about here? You know, that's one of the things that they speculate. Why some of the revelators think that Michael might play a really huge role. Not just, you know, one day in the distant future he'll drop in and say hi, and then, you know, he may be, you know, remember, he's now that he's a master son, he's definitively part of the Supreme Creator personalities, the personalities that create the Supreme. Okay? And this planet is really, really in that equation. It's all about supremacy and how stuff comes together in ways that has never come together before. And that which Revelation failed to accomplish, Revolution does.
And Chris?
Yep.
What if we have a material son who becomes significantly, seriously involved in the affairs of
We're coming now. There's an end of things, you know, just see. Now, let's just read some more. I mean, there's that and a million other things. I mean, there's, you know, and, you know, every time they say, well, you know, this could happen, but there's other opinions too. The whole point is that you just can't say anything definitive. They can't, we can't, because there's so many possibilities. and you can just sit. We could spend hours talking about it.
Right. We can say, yeah. What an adventure.
Yeah.
That's pretty definitive.
What a romance.
There are so
romance.
Many what ifs.
Yeah, you can say that.
That are not even remotely possible in a normal world. Yeah. You know, there is no what ifs like we've got. We've got nothing but what ifs. Right.
A side question.
Yeah.
Your ancient book, of course, doesn't teach that Jesus was a redeemer. Yeah. But when he did become the planetary prince of in it, it's like he I forget the language that it uses, but he reclaimed the title, or he.
Well, you know, I mean, he, you know, he's the second Adam, and I mean, he, you know, he's the living way, you know, literally, like we talked about. I mean, you know, redeemer. Well, what's the truth behind that? You now, you know, if you can be an individual ascender post-Pentecost, you actually can individually ascend now. He has made that way clear again because of the universal bestowal of the Spirit of Truth. Before Pentecost, that wasn't the case. He's redeemed you from, you know, the constraints that you were living under that you know, you had nothing to do with, you know, personally. You were suffering the consequences of others, you know, in the big family that we live in. So, you know, there's a number of things that they point out throughout the book, you know, that it isn't a simplistic atonement salvation model that's in play, but there's all kinds of points of truth, you know, within that limited doctrine that do have you know, a direct relationship with, you know, with the actual picture, and to lift out, you know, to just make, for instance, to make at-one-ment, attunement, you know, to that there isn't a schism that you need, you know, a sacrifice to. To bridge the gap, and so that you can be at one again. But you do need to attune your mind to the cosmic harmony. You know, we've talked about it in other things. I mean, that's, you know, if you think about what they've really replaced that father-like at-one-ment with, they've replaced it with a mother-like attunement. You know, consecrate your will to the will of the Father. But why? You know, is the answer so that you can be at one again? No, you never were really at one. You have a long ascension journey to paradise to really get to the point of true at-one-ment, where you can stand in the presence of the Father. You know, what you're trying to do now is this growth where you're progressively attuning to the Mother. You know, in a sense, the Mother is the Father's way. You know, it's not, you don't just choose, and you know, and it's not like in paradise where you will it and you go from one point to the next. You know, that's not the Father's way. You know, magical jumping from point A to point B. The Father's way is evolutionary, you know, gradual. It's growth. It's the Mother. No. All right. Let's see. So we're right in there.
Such a proclamation in surety and in principle forever settled the status of your world. But in practice, the sovereign Creator Son made no gesture of personal administration of the planet aside from the establishment of the Jerusalem Commission of 24 former Urantians with authority to represent him in the government of Urantia and all other quarantined planets in the system. One of this council is now always resident on Urantia as resident governor general. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I thought they were all together wherever they
at
were.
At the club?
Yes. Exactly.
Section 3 coming up in the papers.
Vicegerent authority to act for Michael as planetary prince has been recently vested in Macaventa Melchizedek. But this son of the local universe has made not the slightest move toward modifying the present planetary regime of the successive administrations of the resident governors general.
Can you kind of feel the Supernafim? Like, and he's not done anything. He's not done anything. read between the lines there, because you'll see he reveals that tension later on. You know, the fact that neither Michael nor Macaventa have, you know, immediately stepped in is not what the Supernafim was immediately hoping for. And I tried to make that point a while back. Remember how, you know, I called him Mr. Intervention? And I remember he's not a seraphim, he's not even a primary Sakonafim, he's a primary Supernafim. Quite removed from immediacy of motherlikeness in terms of just his nature, you know, and it's that's why I'm saying his and not her.
Yeah. How about Macaventa?
No, I'm talking about the primary Supernafim that's writing this paper, who's you know, the chief of the angels. You know.
A little lament here and there.
You know, he's just
chief of seraphim.
Instinct, right? It's chief of seraphim, but because of the rebellion, a primary Supernafim has stepped in and assumed the role of, you know, because our chief that was a seraphim defaulted.
Is it one or two? Is it a pair?
I don't know that Supernafim.
I don't think so. I think it's just a single.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one. I'm pretty sure.
Good question.
But I'm pretty sure it's just a single. Anyway, so that, you know, don't think that you're falsely sticking stuff between the lines. It really is there. Feel that tension just in that. You know, the way he words it. Not the slightest move. Okay, and he's been driving stakes, you know, making sure he doesn't miss even the slightest move. Okay, I mean, you know, and it's not even glacial. It's like nothing. And, okay. So you just pick up on that. It's there.
Well, Melchizedek's probably, you know, since all the variables you've gone over and they stated in here are on this planet, he's probably more in a mode of you know, getting a ping from where the Supreme is headed on this planet, where the Mother is moving.
Well,
you know,
this is not about Melchizedek. This is a primary Supernafim.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but Melchizedek, why he hasn't come back yet? You know, why?
Flipping it the other way around,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But see,
why he hasn't?
You know, is that an immediate intuition thought, you know, or mode of thought for the primary Supernafim? No, see, that's the point I'm trying to make. Yeah, yeah. You know,
it's because of what you emphasized.
The more motherlike it's playing out, the more he's having to challenge himself to not be impatient. It's like, I want to just snap some fingers here. can't we just, you know, go right at it?
And
you know?
These 420 counselors must be rank amateurs.
yes and no.
I mean, compared to what, how he might do things.
If we get here to the next section, notice one of the things they say along that line.
There is little likelihood that any market change will be made in the government of Urantia during the present dispensation unless the vicegerent planetary prince should arrive to assume his titular responsibilities. It appears to certain of our associates that at some time in the near future, the plan of sending one of the 24 counselors to Urantia to act as governor general will be superseded by the formal arrival of Macaventa Melchizedek with the vicegerent mandate of the sovereignty of Urantia. As acting planetary prince, he would undoubtedly continue in charge of the planet until the final adjudication of the Lucifer Rebellion, and probably on into the distant future of planetary settlement and light and life.
Notice how every sentence is, purposely kind of qualified. They don't dare say anything definitive, really.
Some believe that Macaventa will not come to take personal direction of your ancient affairs till the end of the current dispensation. Others hold that the vicegerent prince may not come, as such, until Michael sometime returns to Urantia, as he promised when still in the flesh. Still others, including this narrator, look for Melchizedek's appearance any day or hour.
Especially the hour.
Sounds like some preachers with eternity.
They sure got away from the preachers.
Just notice how many things he didn't have to say, but he's being very honest with us about where he is. He just couldn't say. He had to put in that, including this narrator.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it got approved.
So when they all get together, the planetary government, what arguments he's putting forth in the back and forthing,
hammer down.
he's going. Remember that thing about the heathen, Alan, how they just take the city.
Let's get some of that going.
Why are we messing around here?
One of the other possibilities why Melchizedek hasn't done anything different is that Michael was the one who instituted the 24 vicegerent system. Mm-hmm. And so if Michael, which is another oddball thing to do, you're going to give this to former Urantians and let them be in charge of the planet?
Now remember, it's not totally not separate. Every planet, every normal, every planet has these 24 former mortals that serve as an oversight board for the planet.
Right.
Every rebellion.
No, every world. Every normal world. Every world does. We're actually coming up on it here in a little bit about, there's a normal process to all that. Those councils are, definitely in a different mode with the rebellion worlds. The really distinct thing is not only did Michael just set that up, which is obviously not the normal way it's going to come about. But he gave them, a lot of, he gave them a lot of authority to act in his stead.
Yeah.
And he made them not just oversight over this planet, but all 37 rebellion spheres, not directly, but their oversight of the other groups of 24.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, so those are the things that are really different.
I don't read that there's more than one 24.
Well, not here. Remember, you got to know the entire book. You go to a place where you never expected to be talking about such a thing, and there's a sentence that tells you that every normal world has a group of 24. Exactly. I mean, you have to keep the whole book in mind when you're thinking about these things. It's seldom all in one spot. I can tell you where that is when we get to the spot where it mentions.
Okay. Just a few papers ago, when you were going through the 12.
That's angelic. Yeah.
Okay.
That's different, yeah. Okay, who wants to... Okay, go ahead and get ready.
I have a question. Where are we at with the Lucifer Rebellion and the adjudication?
Where would you like it to be at? Everyone has their opinion. We are not told.
Including this narrator.
Many believe many things.
The
again, it's glacial.
But the book does not tell.
Okay. Well,
the only thing the book tells us is that the adjudication was begun back around the beginning of the 20th century, the same time that Machaventa was given vicegerent, Satan was rounded up, the adjudication began. You don't know if it's going to take 100,000 years to finish. You don't know if it's going to take 5 minutes to finish. We discovered, we know it, yeah. It probably wasn't 5 minutes because, you know, it took longer than 5 minutes to write the book and they didn't, you know, put in a footnote. So, you know, it didn't happen instantly when it was started.
How long did the rebellion last?
200.
Well, I mean, it was 200 on Unity, but it didn't, you know, on Jerusalem, it was over in a couple days.
Yeah. Ancient of Days, two quarter seconds.
You know, we're still playing out here. Galagaster and Dalagaster are still on the planet.
In one respect, it really ended when Jesus said, "Get thee behind me."
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, there's many ways in which it began to end.
Yeah.
I mean, it began, the first time it began to end was when, you know, Van and crew held steadfast through that, and they were given that assignment to stay on, you know, for 150,000 years. You know, a lot of the immediate things ended, you know, in just a short period of time, way back 200,000 years ago. But, you know. You know, remember, that's why they always use the phrase final adjudication. You know, there's kind of many milestones along the way, but at some point, eventually, it's going to be all wrapped up.
Well, we know the trial started back when they talked about it.
Yeah, the adjudication.
So, I'm not going to go against your knowledge of the book. I don't know myself, but the thing is that is there anywhere in the book where it gives what level of the universe is the trial being held on?
Super universe.
Super universe, Salvin.
I mean,
no,
not super universe.
The ancient of days are, you know, I mean, they're always the, remember, there's a reason why they call them the ancients of days, you know, because it's in reference to that.
So as a day is a
judicial
thousand,
passage.
A day in our life is, their day is a thousand years here.
Right, and you have the Havona day and those sorts of issues. But
they say that should it still be a long time for Lucifer to be adjudicated? It'll be from the Aversa perspective, it's as though he was apprehended in 2.5 seconds.
Right.
Okay? I mean, in 200,000 years. So, how long do you want to wait? Maybe another second? is that soon enough for you?
How long? Just a second.
Are you saying I'm an ancient of days?
Well, maybe
I'm
we
saying,
have a. Maybe
I'm saying
we have
like
a,
it's what I said. It could be.
Think like an ancient of days.
Yeah. Maybe we have a clue as to how long a normal trial goes in universal level.
Yeah, they've got that Navona graft.
It's just recognize that you can, you know, all you can do is do what the revelators do. You know, ruminate on this endlessly because there's no resolutions possible.
Well, there's that other mystery too about the 40 adjusters that don't have the bodies to go back to. Remember, they're on Divinington and they don't know what happened to these people that were with the Lucifer rebellion.
I mean, right? I mean, you've got all kinds of loose ends. You've got all of the
they're just like
talking about them last time. All those those personalities that didn't go totally over, but they realized, whoops, you know, that was really stupid, you know, and you know, now they're in sort of suspended animation, you know, in terms of job, you know, for the last 200,000 years. There's all those endless questions.
Food stamps.
Okay.
Two, the Board of Planetary Supervisors. Since the times of Michael's bestowal in your world, the general management of Urantia has been entrusted to a special group on Jerusalem of 24 one-time Urantians. Qualification for membership on this commission is unknown to us, but we have observed that those who have been thus commissioned have all been contributors to the enlarging sovereignty of the Supreme in the system of Satania.
Does that remind you of a conversation we just had? Yeah, that when Andre and I were talking to you, that's a really big clue, see, about just what we were talking about, how much the Supreme is part of what's going on here. You know, and when you think about, you know, no greater man has been born of woman, you know, in reference to John the Baptist, who's on this group, you know, greater in what sense? See, that they're giving a more specific explanation. He's greater in the sense of the supreme. He has, some linkage to supremacy that's transcendent of most, you know, and obviously only began to be manifested in a brief life here. You know, one can only imagine what happened on the mansion worlds and Gerasim training, you know, up to the, you know, until he got actually put on the board. He may have had quite the illustrious mansion world career. As you'll see, he's no slough on the board.
So it says what we do here is important.
Yeah, it could be a beginning of supreme sized things very, very direct, very quickly.
Super sized.
By nature, they were all real leaders when they functioned on Urantia, and accepting Mechavent and Melchizedek, these qualities of leadership have been further augmented by mansion world experience and supplemented by the training of Jerusalem citizenship. Members are nominated to the 24 by the cabinet of Lana Forge, seconded by the Most Highs of Edentia, approved by the assigned sentinel of Jerusalem, and appointed by Gabriel of Salvington in accordance with the mandate of Michael. The temporary appointees function just as fully as do the permanent members of this commission of special supervisors.
For instance, they could be resident governors general.
This board of planetary directors is especially concerned with the supervision of those activities on this world which result from the fact that Michael here experienced his terminal bestowal. They are kept in close and immediate touch with Michael by the liaison activities of a certain brilliant evening star, the identical being who attended upon Jesus throughout the mortal bestowal.
What are some words spoken by that brilliant evening star? Does anyone remember? Bar mitzvah time? There you go.
What is it?
What?
Yeah.
Time to be about your father's
business. Yeah, your hour has come. It's time to begin being about your father's business, or close to those words. That's the brilliant evening star we're talking about. It's always a brilliant evening star on any bestowal mission, even if it's a vonal son. You know, it's time to be about your brother's business in that case. In this case, it's time to be about your father's business. That brilliant evening star that said that.
At the present time, one John, known to you as the Baptist, is chairman of this council when it is in session on Jerusalem. But the ex officio head of this council is the assigned sentinel of Satania, the direct and personal representative of the associate inspector on Salvington, and of the supreme executive of Orvontan.
Okay, so two big things there. One is, you know, not only is John the Baptist on the council, but he's the chairman.
And it only took 2,000 years for him to get to that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay, so you know, see, again, you know, we all have kind of played with that. How long does it take you to get to the mansion? If he has, an innate supremacy potential, he would have had a very accelerated, you know, career through those mansion worlds, and it just seems to all support that recognition, you know, what they're saying about them, that they have a tie to the supreme like few do, so that, you know, they begin to manifest, you know, high measures of supremacy very quickly. I mean, we're all going to, you know, get there as seventh stage spirit beings, but people like John the Baptist are getting going really fast, playing big roles very early on. Okay. The other thing is that whole bit about all the planets having councils of 24. These assigned sentinels. The assigned sentinels, the associate inspectors, and the supreme executives. Remember, you have the seven supreme executives. One for each super universe. And their immediate representatives at the local universe level are the associate inspectors. And then the next immediate representative, there's one in each system, one in each local system. Okay, so there's 7 billion of them. Okay? And we have one in Sicanian. If you go back and read about the assigned sentinels, you'll see that it tells you there that they are always the ex officio head of the councils of 24 on the world. And so every system headquarters has one of these who's the ex officio head of all of the councils of 24 for the worlds in that local system. So that's in a sense, they're giving you what you need. It's like, well, who are assigned sentinels again? You know, and so you go back and you look them up, and then you say, oh, and it's they always give you kind of the clues you need if you just follow them. You know, put all the pieces together. If you don't leave any loose ends in a paragraph, you'll find that the rest of what needs to be said to flesh out the picture is found by following those. Immediate loose ends.
What's specifically meant by ex officio?
I mean, that means, you know, he has that simply because of who he is. You know, I mean, that by title, you know, because of the office he has, because he is an assigned sentinel, therefore he is the head of those councils. It's just by definition. That's what ex officio means.
I do want to get back to the John the Baptist thing that you said mm-hmm. that he may have been, you know, pushed forward up through the mansion.
Not pushed forward, he accelerated.
Accelerated, because he was really accelerating while he was here on Earth, too. I mean, he was really master motivated. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He spent a little time with Jesus when he was little.
You know, and I've tried to point out, it starts right at his birth.
Yeah.
To just notice what day he was born on. And then to think about the supremacy they're telling you he has, and you're going, wow, that's a little bit of supremacy. What day was he born? He was born on March 25th, 7 BC. Now, and for us now, that just goes right over our heads. So what? You got to remember, back then, that was New Year's Day.
Mm-hmm. The equinox.
Yeah, March 25th was when the year number changed. Okay, March 25th was New Year's Day. He was born on New Year's Day of the year that Jesus was born. He literally heralded the year of Jesus' birth. Okay, now think about what has to happen. Was that micromanaged? Now you two, you need to make sure that you conceive, in his day, so that John the Baptist, no. It's just coincidentally happened that he was born on New Year's Day. I mean, the guy is reeking of supremacy from the day he's born.
Right. And it was judiciously imprinted upon him by his parents throughout his life.
It's just once you notice that, it's like, wow, that is really interesting. You know that's not a coincidence. And just the more you think about it, it's like, wow, I can hardly wait to meet him. He must be
and his birth is quite miraculous, too, because he was born to a woman who shouldn't have been able
All this stuff, his birth, was announced in advance, and or his conception and all that.
It seems to me that if you look at the unfolding of the genetic stock on the planet, that there's this unfolding of genetics, and then the appearance in every one of the Sangic races. You see it unfold, then there's a point at which a master spiritual leader appears, and I think that holds true throughout the unfolding of the genetic inheritance of the planet, that there are key points at which this mutant genius appears. I suspect that they were watching for that they were looking for that type of a religious genius who could lay a foundation so that Michael could come and talk about the kingdom, do his revelation, but build it on a human foundation. I suspect that was key to the time of his appearance.
And just let these conversations be part of your consciousness, this sort of recognition. I mean, just how profound the universe is that you live in. I mean, things as seemingly irrelevant as the day someone is born, it is no more irrelevant than the ninth digit in those angel numbers. There's just nothing. I mean, you know, there is a first source and center of all things and beings. You know, the date of a birth is a thing. Okay? There's a first source and center of that. There's a first source and center of everything. You know, everything is connected. You know? And the more that supremacy begins to manifest, the more that will be obvious to those of us who don't have very discerning eyes. You know, more and more it'll be blatant. That this can only be explained by the fact that there's one source and center of all things in being. You know, that it comes together so incredibly like this. All right. So anyway, so you know, go back and you know during the week and check up on supreme executives, associate inspectors, and assigned sentinels.
Yeah, they're
concerned with the master.
They'll be less abstract for you now. You'll kind of get a sense of how they, you know, they fit into the picture a little bit more.
The members of this same commission of former Urantians also act as advisory supervisors of the 36 other rebellion isolated worlds of the system. They perform a very valuable service in keeping Lana Forge, the system sovereign, in close and sympathetic touch with the affairs of these planets, which still remain more or less under the over-control of the constellation Fathers of Nerlaeshadek. These 24 counselors make frequent trips as individuals to each of the quarantined planets, especially to Urantia.
So not just because they're coming as a resident governor general. They're traveling around all the time. So they're sort of the opposite of, was it Eugene? You may be originally thinking they're all kind of just stuck there on Gerasim. You know, you get the sense that it's probably kind of rare that, you know, that a lot of them are on Gerasim.
Each of the other isolated worlds is advised by similar and varying sized commissions of its one-time inhabitants. But these other commissions are subordinate to the Urantian group of 24. While the members of the latter commission are thus actively interested in every phase of human progress on each quarantined world in Satania, they are especially and particularly concerned with the welfare and advancement of the mortal races of Urantia, for they immediately and directly supervise the affairs of none of the planets except Urantia. And even here, their authority is not complete, excepting in certain domains concerned with mortal survival.
Okay, now there's a huge... And are they going to elaborate? No. Of course not.
What do you mean?
Is that the survival in the flesh or survival in eternity?
Survival in the flesh.
No. I mean, why not?
No, survival.
Well, mortal survival. You know, that just means, you know, they just survive mortal death. Mortal death.
Right.
Pertaining to death. Surviving death. You know, but what?
Yeah. So well, there's some easy deductions. We know that nobody but the Ancients of Days can rule against. Therefore, the only thing that they can be talking about is to rule in favor. So in other words, there could be individuals. Let's take somebody at random. No, I won't pick Don Green. But you know, somebody who's questionable. Somebody who's questionable. No, I said I'm not going to pick Don Green.
Yeah.
Because it's so not applicable.
Yeah. Never know. The fact is that you know, you get somebody like, you know, who might be questionable for various reasons, who maybe function in the Pol Pot regime or whatever. You know, pick whoever you're thinking about. And somehow on this Council of 24, they may say, you know, this guy might have something to offer if we just let him survive.
Right. And how do they have that wisdom? Eyes of supremacy. See that again. See it all. Just remind yourself. See, now that you know who they are, what can they see that others can't see? Andre's got it. I think that's you know, that's part of why they're doing that. You know, because even the Seraphim are going, I don't think so.
Ringing my bell.
Yeah. But the 24 say, no, we see something you don't see.
Well, these 24,
and on all of the other 36 worlds, these are like the ones that are leading them to. They're like,
yeah,
because,
yeah,
wow,
yeah, yeah, because, you know, some of them, like the neighboring planet, you know, had both a rebellion and a default, like we did.
Yeah,
yeah. So there's a Council 24 on that one, but our Council 24 oversees them.
Oversees, right?
Yeah. You know, and related to
well,
the really
that was the
big
question.
Picture
so what,
issues.
Why was it? Because of Michael Pistole.
Yeah.
That was it. Okay.
Michael, rather than doing it directly, he's chosen to use these 24 as a way of over controlling this situation. In other words, he's chosen to take 24 very supreme like beings to function in his stead. See, just think about what he's done and what that means. He's purposely imposing even more supremacy upon. Sort of necessary supremacy. Just think about his choices.
He believes in experience.
Yeah, he's going to trust in the big picture.
And actually, I don't see where it doesn't say 24 for the other.
Oh, that the varying, varying size.
Yeah.
Remember, I mean, ours. You know, we only we don't have all 24 permanent.
Right.
So they're telling you that you know. It's all varying size in terms of how many are permanent right now. But, you know, it's a commission of 24 that has varying size permanent. And if you go back again and look, you know, it just says point blank, they're 24. That's the size of these commissions. And depending upon how they've played out, I mean, those other worlds didn't have a John the Baptist. You know, they didn't have a Machiavent and Melchizedek. You know, probably. At least the neighboring planet apparently didn't. There's no sign of it from the story. et cetera. You know, they certainly didn't have Onagar and Mansant. You know, from the pre-colored race. You know, from the Andonites. You know, so there's a whole bunch of things like that. You know, that they may definitely be smaller just because they had fewer things that needed to be sort of spanned to get a complete sampling. Of the history, but that's you know if you go back and look at ours, you know the ones that are on there of the 24 span the whole spectrum of who we are and what we've been.
Right.
Punctuation points.
Right. Yeah. It's sort of the distillations of all the essentials of the whole history.
No one knows how long these 24 Urantia counselors will continue in their present status, detached from the regular program of universe activities. They will no doubt continue to serve in their present capacities until some change in planetary status ensues, such as the end of a dispensation, the assumption of full authority by Machiavent and Melchizedek, the final adjudication of the Lucifer rebellion, or the reappearance of Michael on the world of his final bestowal. The President Resident Governor General of Urantia seems inclined to the opinion that all but Machiaventa may be released for Paradise Ascension the moment the system of Satania is restored to the constellation circuits. But other opinions are also current.
Well, that's definitive.
Yes.
Does that mean that they suspended their fusion?
No.
They've
fused on their way up.
Oh yeah, they've got that up
to Jarrett.
They're not coming back onto a planet physically. You're thinking
not physically, but the normal progression as you go through.
It's not like the Prince's staff where they hadn't fused,
right. And
the Justices were taken away, and they were sort of kept from being pulled up by spiritual gravity, literally because their adjuster was unplugged from them. It's not
so,
like that.
So John the Baptist is fused.
Right. I mean, they're...
The rest of
all these guys.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know, it have to be. Think about what we've been saying, you know. Yeah. So, now, you know, there's some exceptions to this. I mean, Machiavent and Melchizedek is on there.
Right.
Okay, he didn't fuse with his adjuster.
Oh, right.
1, 2, 3, the first is on there. He doesn't have an adjuster.
Right.
You know, and most likely never will because he's a primary. He eventually could have some sort of a father fragment like the angels do. You know, the ascending angels. Yeah, but it's only it's secondary midwayers that if they go all the way up, make it into the core of finality, have an adjuster like you and I. You know, so there's all those issues coming into play. But all right. Okay. So then, we'll just pick up the thing to notice here. What's happening at the beginning. I'm not talking about seraphim very much. I thought this was entitled Seraphic Planetary Government. You know, they were, you know, alluded to there was, you know, all this bit about many of them are functioning in this role. So this first part is a lot about the planetary government. They're building up. They want you to understand, you know, in what context the seraphim are playing this role. You know, and how different it is than on a normal world. And because it's quite a bit different, you know, it's important to understand how it's different. In many ways, they take on the potential for even more definitive father-like action, you know, because you're dealing with exigencies, you know, and disruptions and, you know, et cetera. So if you just, you know, just kind of notice those details. I'm trying to ask yourself why, you know, because by answering those questions, it helps you to appreciate what they're trying to get you to recognize with these papers.
Well, particularly, yeah. Like Machiavenna noticed with the spiritual evolution on Urantia before he decided to come down, it was grinding to a halt and actually threatening to start going backwards.
Right.
And that's when he decided to come in.
Look what's happening right now.
And how hard it is, unlike back then, when all there was were 12 Melchizedek receivers. So if there was going to be some sort of an intervention, I wonder who's going to do it. You know, I'll bet it's going to be one of the 12 Melchizedek receivers. But, you know, like they're just trying to find out. Now, I mean, no one can say. I mean, there's so many different possibilities.
Yeah.
Of what could happen to deal with what Don is just pointing out. You know, the emergencies that are looming here, the descending lines that are in play.
Huge
ones. So, that's all. That's part of this, too. All right, so we'll pick up on the rest of the planetary government next time, and then we'll get to the seraphim after that. Okay, let's take a moment here.